brain systems. What I want to do today is basically the following. One is we have to talk about class structure, class structures. So even constrained systems have a class system. Two, we're going to talk about the third example I talked about, which is electromagnetism. It's not that much harder to extend that to Yang-Mills theory. And then I want to talk about our first diffeomorphism invariant theories, which are some topological field theories. And this is where we start to get into the cool, newer material, topological field theories. And in particular, today we'll talk about a class of theories called BF theories, not because they're named after somebody called B and somebody called F, but just because that's what they're called. Okay. Good. Any questions from previous times? Okay. Everybody happy? I need an eraser, or I'm not happy. Anybody see there? So would anybody be uncomfortable just to review a little bit what we said about dynamical systems with constraints? Let me just, I'll do that quickly to make sure everybody, we're all on the same page. So we start with an action. We have the action is an integral over some time parameter ds of a Lagrangian, which is a function of some variables we call q and q dot, which are their derivatives with respect to s. We are trying to solve the variational problem that delta s is 0. And we do it by looking at equations which are first time derivatives or time rate of change. So we convert to Hamiltonian language. We start by defining a momenta, PAI, which is the rate of change of the action or the variation of the action with respect to the q's. And as before, the indices I, j, k, and things like that run from 1 to n and are the number of particles. We have n particles. And the indices a, b, c run from 1 to the dimension of space. We then have a phase space, which is the space of all the q's and the p's. And I think I forgot to say it last time that, of course, we immediately have a Poisson bracket. No, I did say it last time, but written in terms of these, that's the formula for the Poisson bracket. Now, the new thing from Dirac is that sometimes these equations are not invertible so that one can't get rid of all the q dots in constructing the Hamiltonian. And this happens when some of these equations are just constraints, and I think I called them pi before. They're just functions of the q's and the p's, which are thus equal to 0. And when we get such constraints, the momenta are only defined in for the points on the space where that equation holds, or there could be several such equations. So we call that the constraint surface. And we can only study the dynamics, because the p's are defined so that this is true, we can only study the dynamics on the surface. And in particular, we can only make the Hamiltonian picture on the surface. The Hamiltonian, we start with h0, which is the usual p q dot minus l. But we have to, we're really interested, we have to add the constraints in order to make sure that we only define the Poisson brackets, that we only study the Poisson brackets on the constrained surface. So let me put it this way. This is sometimes called H0, and then we add Lagrange multipliers times the constraints. And there's some number of constraints, say I'll label them by R, so that this Hamiltonian depends on the Q's and the P's and some bunch of Lagrange multipliers. Okay. Then the key idea is that we want to evolve. We want to study the equations of motion which have to keep us on this constrained surface. So that means that we have to study whether the time derivatives of these constraints are zero, which are given by their Poisson brackets with the Hamiltonian, and this has to be zero. Now, in the examples that we looked at, this results in some additional constraints, C, and there's some number of them, are some additional constraints equal to zero. Because these are equations that hold by definition, by the very definition of what the momenta are. Okay. So they had better be always true. If we started with some initial P's and Q's and evolved and they no longer were true, then we would be on a path which didn't correspond to the equations of motion. Because these are true by virtue of the very definition of the momenta. Okay. So we have to check that if we start with some initial conditions for the system which are on the constraint surface, that it stays there. Yeah. And we looked at some examples where this produced some additional constraints. And we add these, so we now look at an even more constrained surface. We add these, and we add these to the Hamiltonian. These were called primary constraints because they come from the very definition of the momenta, and these are called secondary. And we keep recycling. We then take C and we say, is C dot zero? Okay, and we go through it, and either now what we want, let me modify this. What we want is that this is weakly zero, that is it's zero on the constraint surface. And we'll often be using this notation, means weakly equal to, which means equal to when you're on the constraint surface. And if you generate a constraint and it's not preserved by the evolution, you may generate more constraints. But that's not the only thing that can happen. The other thing that can happen is that you can get some equation that determines the Lagrange multipliers. And the best way to explain that is with an example. So eventually we'll have an example where that happens. And you keep going. Dirac says, keep going until you reach the state where you have a list of constraints. You've added them to the Hamiltonian, so you always do the evolution varying the Lagrange multipliers to keep you on the constraint surface. And the system is consistent, meaning all the constraints that you impose stay imposed. And at that point, you're done with this list. Okay, question?
Surface that's allowed in those equations? Could you get two or three?
You mean these equations could be bizarre equations with various roots and things?
Yeah.
Sure.
So in general, you could have many different possible surfaces.
The worse it is, the harder your job you'll have for making quantum mechanical theory. So there are branches. Sometimes they're quadratics, cubics, and so forth. You basically, as we proceed, anything which is a constraint, which is linear in the momenta, is going to be easy to deal with, even if it's a function of the variables. Anything which is quadratic or higher in the momenta, one way or the other, is going to be trouble. Yeah?
May I see that you have disjoint constraint surfaces?
You have what?
Disjoint constraint surfaces, or are they all connected?
I've never seen disjoint, but this is a general theory.
I mean, is there a theory down?
I have no idea. I have no idea. Let me express some frustration, not towards you, but there is a whole subject called constrained Hamiltonian dynamics, where there's all sorts of abstract stuff and theorems and artificial examples. And my attitude towards that subject, and there are conferences in that subject you can go to and so forth, my attitude towards that subject is that in nature, we're really only interested in a few of these. We're interested in general relativity, we're interested in electromagnetism, we're interested in Yang-Mills theory, we're interested in string theory, and various things connected to those. We're not interested in, at least as fundamental theoretical physicists, the generic case. But there are nevertheless, there are people who study the generic case, but I'm not one of them, so I, there are many questions like that I don't know the answer to. The examples we'll have to deal with are bad enough, so see. Yes, Sean?
Is there a procedure for actually finding the constraints in the first place?
This is the procedure.
Well, even just finding the piles, right?
Look at these equations. They either involve Q dot explicitly or they don't.
Okay.
If they don't involve Q dot explicitly, they're a constraint.
Oh. Okay.
That in principle they could, because the Lagrangian was a function of Q and Q dot. We took a variational derivative, so we have a P here. So this stuff here is generically a function of Q and Q dot. In a special case, where it's just a function of Q and not Q dot, then we call it a primary constraint.
Okay. But is it always, isn't it hard sometimes to, like if?
No, this is an algorithm.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. And there is an algorithm. I haven't really, in a careful way, given you the algorithmic procedure to keep plugging back in, but there is one. I mean, assuming that the original Lagrangian had solutions to the equations of motion, so you're dealing with a system that has solutions, then you will. Then the procedure will stop.
How do you know when you found all the constraints?
That's a very good, important question. You know when you found all of them when you've checked all of their time derivatives, and they are weakly zero. Either by because it's weakly zero, or because they're, what you get is some equations that determine the Lagrange multipliers, which sit here.
But there is an issue, sorry.
Yeah.
There is an issue, isn't it? Because in the example you gave last time, with the Barber, okay, I mean, there was a constraint, but it wasn't obvious right away.
That's because it was not linear in the momenta.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. Actually, I stand correct. Okay. So to correct myself, the cases that are linear in the momenta come out automatically because their P is proportional to something. Cases where there are other constraints, yes, you're right, and I don't know an algorithm, so I correct myself. Good. Okay. Is everybody there in Western and Guelph? Hello? Okay. It would be nice if you guys can ask questions too sometime. Oh, there's Western. Okay. Good? They are arbitrary variational parameters. They're Lagrange multipliers. So they are to be varied to find the equations of motion, which gives you back the constraints. Sometimes the procedure of conserving the constraints determines them as functions of the Q's and P's, and then you have this expression and they're fixed. Now let me say something hand-waving, which
I'm not going to tie down, but Dirac ties down, which is that the freedom in the lambdas, when you don't, when they're not tied down, means that the evolution that of variables from this Hamiltonian is ambiguous, because lambda is our arbitrary functions of time, and that corresponds to gauge invariances in the Lagrangian picture. And I'm not going to make a trace that correspondence through in detail, but it's sketched in Dirac, and it's done in painstaking detail in Teitelboim and Hanau and Teitelboim. Okay. Thank you. And by the way, people are friends at Western, and well, if I ever forget to put on the microphone or you otherwise can't hear, yell and scream, okay?
Okay.
Where is my other blackboard? Way up there, okay. There we are, okay. Now, class structure. Okay. Dirac says you should look at the algebra of constraints. Why should you look at the algebra of constraints? Because in wanting to preserve some constraints, and I'm going to just generically call them CR, in wanting to compute that, you're taking the Poisson bracket, of the constraint with H, and that's the Poisson bracket of the constraint with the zero part, plus a sum over the constraints times lambda p, let me call it that summation p, and this is cr, times the Poisson bracket of cr cp. So a lot of interest in sorting this out is what happens to the Poisson brackets of cr with cp. Of the constraints with themselves. And there are three cases. There's the cases where for CR and CP is the case where they're equal, well, actually let me write it as an equality here, where they're equal to some constants F, R, P, say, T times C, T. In other words, what you get here is a term proportional to something which is already a constraint. And then this term goes away on the constraint surface. So in this case, what this means is that you are generating a Lie algebra. And this case is called first class. In other words, in the list of constraints, C1, C2, up to C18, say, there'll be some subset of them, say C1 to C10, that form a Lie algebra. Under Poisson brackets, they close with each other. And that's a very nice case. And that's a way in which you're going to see the emergence of gauge symmetries. Now, in the examples we discussed before, we just basically had one interesting constraint. So this was not relevant, but we're going to see examples with infinite numbers. And this is going to be very relevant. Another possibility is that this doesn't happen. That is, this equals some, let me call it W, RP, which is not proportional to constraints. And these might be functions of the Qs and the Ps. And in this case, so for example, a typical example is, you get pairs which just give you one. Okay, now sometimes you can't, sometimes you have to fiddle with the thing to know whether these are going to be more constraints or not if they're functions, but if they're just numbers, you're done, you're dead. Okay? So these are called second class. And you don't generate algebras with them. And then there's another possibility which Dirac doesn't actually mention explicitly, but happens examples, which is sort of like first class, but it's where these coefficients are actually functions of the q's and the p's. Okay, so you might get, it might be that the result of the Poisson bracket will be proportional to constraints, but they'll be functions of the dynamical variables here. Okay? In that case, it's not a Lie algebra. It's not a Lie algebra because the axioms of Lie algebras are that just the you have some objects who commute to give you other objects in the algebra, and this is not something in the algebra, it's just proportional to something in the algebra. Okay? So these unfortunately occur in examples that we're most interested in, for example, general relativity itself. And these are called business class, because they're not quite first class. And because we have to deal with them. Okay? So that's the class structure of the airplane of the constraint surface. Okay, now, the nice cases are the first class, and for the next while, we're just going to be, so far we've only discussed first class. We have not run into any second class. And we're going to be discussing mostly first class in this class, although we will stumble across a second class. The first class ones are of interest because they correspond to the algebras and they therefore generate symmetries. And in fact, it will be motivating. They generate gauge symmetries because then you don't determine the Lagrange multipliers. So you just get evolution with ambiguity, and that corresponds. So you're going to get algebras associated with gauge invariants. The second class is not associated with gauge invariants in any way that anybody's ever figured out. There are basically three ways of dealing with them. Sometimes you can just go to a sector, and we'll see an example of this. You can just cross out some variables in pairs, so these no longer exist in your system. So I mean, sometimes, you know, there are simple cases where this is a P and this is a Q, you know, this is P1 and this is Q1,
and they don't appear anywhere else, and you just have some dumb thing like P1, Q1 equals 1, minus 1 actually, and those are constraints. And so then you can just cross out P1 and Q1, and your system just reduces. Okay, that's the nice case. Then there's a not nice case where Dirac claims you can take these matrices and invert them and redefine the brackets. And I've never seen an interesting case where that led anywhere, but Dirac discusses it. And then there's the case where even that doesn't work. So basically, either these are immediately deal withable, or they're a real problem. And there's a literature of papers about quantization of arbitrarily ugly systems with second-class constraints. They occur, but that literature is useless. I mean, either you can deal with it immediately, or you have a theory that you're going to regret. You're going to have regrets about having spent time with. Okay. Okay, so let's now talk about some examples. And The next example is electromagnetism. But because that introduces a new issue, which is Hamiltonian dynamics of fields, we're going to do the scalar field first. Okay? So Hamiltonian scalar fields. And we do this just to get our tools ready. If you've never dealt with Poisson brackets of fields, there's just some things that you need to know. You need to have your tools sharpened, or you'll make mistakes. Okay, so the action is, and let's just do this in four dimensions and be lazy, d4x of space-time, eta mu nu, del mu phi, del mu phi, signature plus minus minus minus, which means it's minus some potential functional of phi. And what this really is, since we'll need it in a minute, this is phi dot. Let me write this out in a little bit more detail. Integral dt is the time coordinate. Integral d3x of space. There should be a 1/2 here that I forgot. There is a 1/2 phi dot of x and t squared, a minus 1/2 gradient of phi in the spatial direction squared, and a minus potential of phi. Okay? So many of you have dealt with that. This is a system, as we'll see, without constraints, but I just want to make sure that everybody knows how to differentiate field quantities. Okay? So we start the same way. So I told you before we're going to have to pay attention to who is a density and who is not a density and so forth. So phi is not a density. So there really is secretly a square root of the metric there, if you're thinking generally covariantly. And let's bring that along for a while. Okay? So let's find out the momenta. The momenta are traditionally called pi's. They are also a function of x and t. This is the variation of the action delta phi dot, which is at a point x and t. You vary, there's a square, there's a 2, and this is simply phi dot as a function of x and t. Okay? So there is no constraint anywhere because you account for, there's a pi at every point of space and a phi dot at every point of space. It's therefore straightforward to define the Hamiltonian is now the integral over all the points of space of pi of x, phi dot of x, minus Lagrangian. Lagrangian density is all this stuff. And oh, and I forgot, you know, I went to a lot of trouble and I forgot the key point already. The key point is that there's a square root of g there. Sorry, I even get it wrong. It's here. There's a square root of the metric there. Okay. That's why I went through all this trouble to write this whole thing down so that I could point to that. What that means is that the momenta is a density, and we honor that by putting a twiddle over it. So densities always have twiddles put over them. Okay? And this is a density of weight 1 because there's 1 power square root of x. Therefore, there is a twiddle here so that this term is a density. And the Lagrangian is also a density because it's something that was integrated. It includes the square root of x. Sorry, the square root of g. We then replace phi dot as pi over square root of g. And this comes out to be the integral of d3x. of pi squared, which is a density, and that gives you two density weights, because there are two pi's there. Therefore, this is over square root of g. And then minus the rest of the Lagrangian is plus square root of g times 1/2 gradient of phi squared plus v of phi. Okay? So I did all of that just to be able to point to, we always integrate densities, so there's a 1 over square root of determinant of g here, and there's a square root of determinant of g there. That, you know, Weinberg and so forth don't write down because they're not thinking about space-time. Yes? Four metric, because there's also a density in time. Good. Good question. Yes, thank you very much. 1/2. Okay. I think we're not going to need this anymore, so I'll just come here. This was pi phi dot, which is 1, minus pi dot minus 1/2 phi dot squared. So it's 1 of this minus 1/2 is, yeah. And now I'm going to write something that maybe you think is trivial, but it's important to go through it once. So the Poisson bracket of phi of x of t, pi of y of t, is delta 3 at x and y. But what is this object which we so cavalierly write down? The delta function. Notice that this is a density in pi, because pi is a density. So we're losing a density at y. And that means that this object is a density in y and not x. Okay? And what that means is that if you're careful when you write a formula like integral d3y f of y delta 3 of x and y, and so this is a familiar formula, is f of x. That's how we use the delta function. But I want everybody to stop if you're not used to this. If you're used to this, I'm sorry if this is irritating to be reminded of it. But if you're not used to it, here I'm integrating over y. F of y is a function. So in order to be able to define this integral, you need a density weight. And the density weight is in the Dirac delta function. And this Dirac delta function, this is not the thing that people write down in coordinates as x minus y. It's not that. It's an interesting singular object, which is a function of two points on the manifold. And in one of them, it's a density, and the other one, it's not. So it's not symmetric. And therefore, when you integrate over it to do the usual stuff, you have to always remember to be integrating over the one that's the density. Unless you happen to have an object here which already is a density, in which case you had better be integrating over x instead. Okay, so we're going to be careful about stuff like that. And we're just going to check that we are careful about stuff like that by computing pi dot, which is the Poisson bracket, I'm sorry, phi dot of phi of x with the Hamiltonian. And so what is this? This is the integral d3y of the Poisson bracket of phi at x with pi squared of y over determinant g of x. Now, phi commutes with phi, so we don't have to write this term. There's a 1/2. Poisson brackets work like derivatives. So this is 2 times pi like this. And this is the integral d3y pi twiddle of y. Whoops, but there's this over determinant of g delta 3 of x and y. And in the end, this is pi twiddle of x over square root of g. Okay, and you see that I integrate, this is a density in y, and the square root of g saves me, pi is a density, but it's divided by the determinant, so it's not a density, so we can integrate. Okay. So this is just, and then you can, I'll leave it as an exercise. You can go ahead and compute pi dot. Okay, just pointing out kinds of things to be careful about. Okay, any questions? So let's see. So now let's do electromagnetism. And by the way, the reason why I'm being pedantic about things like density factors is that if you look in the history of the literature about gauge theories and general relativity, there's a whole lot of papers into the 1960s which are just wrong, literally just wrong, calculationally wrong, because people messed up stuff about density weights, integration by parts, and basic stuff, which they were not aware of because the whole thing had not been thought through carefully enough. So there's a lot of statements about the commutator algebra, the algebra of the constraints in general relativity and Yang-Mills theory. Even at the quantum theory is non-trivial, but even at the classical level, there's a lot of mistakes in the literature. So the way to avoid that is to really be ruthless. I mean, obviously, you do all the standard things like check dimensions and check, but really be ruthless about being conscious of integration by parts and density weights. Okay. So electromagnetism. So in electromagnetism, we have a vector potential A, and I'll use indices mu for space-time for 0, 1, 2, 3. And I'll use indices A for space 1, 2, 3. That's not completely consistent with what I'll be doing in some later discussions with the indices, but that's what I'll do. How many people here and out there are happy with form notation and just dropping all the indices? OK, is there anybody who's not? You like the indices over there? Okay, we'll keep the indices. Don't worry. Okay. So this is a one form, and the curvature or electromagnetic field strength, F mu, is derivative with respect to X mu del mu minus del mu A mu. And the action is minus 1/4 integral over space and time d4x F mu nu, F alpha beta, the metric mu alpha, this is just the metric of Minkowski space, nu beta, and again, there's a square root of the metric there. Okay, I'm going to do this straightforwardly, and I might even do it a second way to make a point, but I'll do it the straightforward way first. Yeah? It may or may not, depending on whether I remember my signatures, make the Hamiltonian positive with the signs that were already on the blackboard. That's the minus sign, and we'll see if it may not work. Okay? It's a minus with one signature. I don't even remember if it changes sign the signature. Probably not, because there are two eta's, but we'll see. I'm pretending to be consistent with the signature eta 1, minus 1, minus 1, like that. And I hope that smarter people than me will catch the sign mistakes as they go by. Okay? So I want to write this out in a little more detail. Integral dt, integral d3x, let's keep the square root of the metric there. And there are two terms here. F is, of course, anti-symmetric. This is a key property. It's minus F nu mu. And therefore, they can't both be zero for time. But there is one where this is zero, and the other one is a spatial index. So let me expand that. There's a del 0 AA minus del A A0. And I just expanded one of those. That's multiplied times F 0 A. I raised two indices. One of them changed sign. So there's a minus sign. And there are two terms like that. So this becomes a 1 half. So I get a plus, plus. And then there's still a minus 1 quarter, FAB, FAB. And there are two changes of sign here, so that doesn't change sign. Okay? And when this is, oh, sorry, I already took out the 1 half. That's a 1, an extra 1 half. Thank you. Good. Because I was dumb and I raised the indices, and raising a spatial index changes sign, and raising a time index does not.
Fine, you're right. You actually are right, not wrong. You change the sign if I write it like that. Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure.
Okay, so. Let's find the momenta. And there are, first of all, the momenta for the zero component, which is delta of the action, delta A zero dot. But there is no occurrence of the time derivative of the zero component of A in the action. And notice that that follows from the asymmetry of F, from the fact that there's no 0, 0, because F is asymmetric, this is 0. And that is our first set of primary constraints. So the momenta conjugate to A0 are 0. And then for the spatial ones, for the spatial dots, okay, we're taking the derivative, we're taking the variation by these terms here. So we get square root of g, we get f0a, and thanks to the gentleman there, the sign is right, and there is a factor of 2, because we might have done it here, or we might have done it here, so that cancels the remaining 1 half Okay, and so, and this, the F is just the name for this. So there is a time derivative in here. So since there's a time derivative in here, there's no primary constraint from here. Because this has inside of it the time derivative of the spatial part of A minus the spatial derivative of the time part of A. Okay. Now something very interesting happens. Do I want that board? Well, if I want it, I'll have it later. Okay. So let's find the H0, which is the integral of space. So the integral of space corresponds to summing all the indices that we had before. So we always have that there. Pi A times A dot A plus pi 0 times A dot 0 minus the Lagrangian. And again, if you're worrying about density weights, the pi's are density weights. So this is integrable, and the Lagrangian is always a density. Okay. And if we do that, we have an A dot, so we can trade this A dot for the pi, but there's another term in there. So in other words, if we look at this, what this says is that A dot of A is, and let me bring the 1 over square root of G there, is pi A, and I'm going to bring this term around now, plus del A, A0. Okay, and so I use that here, and so I get integral d3x. I start off by something that looks like pi A over square root of G. That's a lot like the scalar field case. And I'm doing what I said I wouldn't do. So let me, what's really here is the delta AB, the summation there. Now, I'm going to get two of those as well from subtracting the Lagrangian. And there's a 1/2. So I'm going to get an overall 1/2 there. However, there's this other term, which is del A0. So I have another term here, which is pi A del A0. And I think I have just one of those. Then I still have, there's nothing I can do to the pi 0. I can't get rid of the A dot 0. So I just have pi 0. A dot 0 is before. And the other thing that's left over from minus the Lagrangian is the F squared in the spatial part. So I get plus 1/4 FAB FAB. And I, let me be explicit, delta AC delta DD. Okay. So that's my H0. Now, I'm going to now write the H, the full H, which you remember is this plus Lagrange multipliers times the constraints. And I just have one constraint, which is here. So I'm just, this is going to look almost the same, but there, I'm going to make two changes. So I'll have this. And I'm going to start to compress on notation where it doesn't matter much. So square just means summing on all the indices, on all the spatial indices as given. Then what I'm going to do here is I'm going to integrate by parts just to make life easier in a minute. And I'm going to comment on that. So this term is minus a0, the gradient of pi. And by the way, for those who care about covariance, notice that this is the ordinary gradient of a vector density. And if you remember your tensor calculus, you'll remember that this is actually well defined. This is a density itself. It's well defined without having to have a covariant derivative here. Mm-hmm. So that's very nice that that comes for free like that. And then I just have left over from here. Well, then I also have, and I'm going to be explicit about it, an integral on the boundary of whatever spatial manifold I have here. And the thing that I have here is a0 pi a. That's what I get from the integral by parts. And the boundary, do I want to force you to deal with that now? No. OK. So we're going to make a little helpful proviso. We're going to add some boundary conditions. And you know what? We're going to do this the easiest possible way, in that we're going to say the spatial manifold has no boundary. So the spatial manifold, its boundary is 0. So for example, it could really be the 3 torus rather than R3. And that's the easiest thing to do. And I don't have to worry you with how I notate boundary terms. We'll have to worry about that later. And then I have the pi 0 constraint. And a pi 0 constraint comes with a Lagrange multiplier, plus I still have left over a dot 0. And that's my Hamiltonian. Okay? And just for fun, I'm just going to redefine a dot 0 is some function. Doesn't matter. It's some function of space and time. The Lagrange multiplier is a free function of space and time. So I'm just going to call this lambda prime. OK. Notice that in case, just want to bother you with this. Notice that in case there was a boundary, we would possibly have a boundary term in the Hamiltonian. And that is very important when there is a boundary. So it's not, we will want to come back later and think about that. OK. So now let's play the game of Dirac. The game of Dirac is we want to preserve the primary constraints. We have one primary constraint per point, which is pi 0. We want to take its time derivative. We want to know, is it 0? What it's equal to is the Poisson bracket of pi 0 with the Hamiltonian. And that's the same thing as the variation. This is at some point x on the spatial manifold. So that's the same thing as the variation of the Hamiltonian with the field a0 at the point x. And don't be confused by my dumbness. Let's call this the point y, because we've already used the point x upstairs. OK? Sorry about that, because we have here an integral d3x. OK, well, a0 appears only one place in this Hamiltonian, which is right here. So therefore, I get the divergence of pi as the quantity at the point y, which tells me whether pi 0 is preserved or not. And that is another constraint. There's nothing to do about that but call that a constraint. So I'm going to give that a name. That's called G. That's a function of the point Y. And we're going to add that to the constraint. So we're going to make that 0. So in other words, the constraint surface, I'm going to come back over here in a minute. The constraint surface, the phase space is a space of fields AA, A0, pi A, and pi 0. And we have a constraint surface, and we have that pi 0 equals 0, and that these functions G equals 0. And these are both functions on the spatial manifold. So we have two constraints. Per point. Okay? So what I'm going to do, I don't want to rewrite everything. This, I said, is times lambda prime. So I'm going to just add a term proportional to G. And again, I already have a term proportional to G, which is proportional to A naught. So I have the same game. I have A naught plus a Lagrange multiplier. In other words, I get to add a term. Let me call it a different thing. Let's call it omega times G. Notice that G is a density, so I can integrate it. But I have also G over here. So I'm really going to call this omega prime, that is omega prime is whatever was my original Lagrange multiplier plus A0. And then I get rid of this. And I guess I can make it tidier if everybody wants to see it. Plus omega prime times G plus lambda prime times pi 0. And that's my Hamiltonian. OK. Yes? I'm free to, lambda is really, or omega there is really a free functional. So what I can define it to be whatever function A0 is plus something else. You could keep it, and keeping it will involve you, will not cost you anything. We'll show you why in a minute. So if you prefer, I don't mind keeping it if you prefer to keep it. So let's, okay. Well, I'll show you in a minute what the cost of keeping it is. Okay. Good. So we have to just keep going. And since what we need to do is now compute G dot at the point Y, which is the Poisson bracket of G at Y with H, the full H. And I'm going to break that into some pieces, because that has several parts. Okay. And so what I really want to do is first ask you, so H is a function of A's and pi's. It's also a function of the Lagrange multipliers, but it doesn't, the Lagrange multipliers have vanishing Poisson brackets with everything. So I think what I want to do to start with is, before I compute this, I want to compute delta A, which is the Poisson bracket at a point Y, which is the Poisson bracket of A of Y with, say, G at X. And I'm going to want to do the same thing for pi in a minute, just to break up this calculation into pieces. Okay? And we're going to get an interesting result. Now, there's an infinite number of points A at Y, and there's an infinite number of points G at X. So there's possibilities for confusion from infinities from Poisson brackets. So the advice here is to immediately integrate so that you always have the opportunity to integrate by parts. Basically, if you just, I'll just take this one step. So this is the Poisson bracket of A at Y times d by dx A pi A at X. Now you know the Poisson bracket between A's and pi's. And let me write that out. Again, the Poisson bracket is just like the scalar field, AA of X, pi B of Y, which is again a vector density, is delta 3 XY, which is a density in Y. Okay. But what happens when we hit that with a derivative? Do you get a derivative of a delta function? And what is a derivative of a delta function? And so forth. Now, in this case, you could wing it. If you want to wing it, you would pull the derivative outside, take the Poisson bracket, and get the derivative of a delta function. Okay. But generically, as soon as you confront derivatives of delta functions, you're going to make mistakes. And the reason why you're going to make mistakes is related to the issue that the delta function, see, this is not the delta function on Rn, which is delta of x minus y, that is defined in the textbooks. This is a bifunctional distribution, which is a density in one variable and a function in another variable. And you're going to mess up if you try to discuss derivatives of it. And you're going to be very tempted to do things like, oh, I have d by dx of delta 3 of x and y. Well, that's really just, of course, minus d by dy of delta 3 of x and y, because that's what you could do when they were deltas of x minus y. And you're going to make mistakes. I sound like a Marine sergeant or something like that. Okay. The weight of experience. Of course, you're all probably smarter than we were when we used to mess up with this all the time. So you wouldn't actually make any of these mistakes. But unless you're concerned, the way to avoid making mistakes is always make sure that you have, every time you have a possibility of getting in trouble with something like a derivative of a delta function, you have a handy integral around to integrate by parts. So it's good to define an object, let's call it g of rho, which is the integral, say, g3z of just some function rho of z, g of z. And then you can already, so this is the integral d3z rho of z d by dza pi a, where that's the density of z. And you can already integrate by parts. That's minus integral d3z del a of rho of z times pi a. So you can get the derivatives off the pi's, which are about to disappear. And then it's a step to do the Poisson bracket. So delta a, and I'll call it delta A of rho now at a point Y, is the Poisson bracket of AA at the point Y by G of rho. So in other words, rather than doing the infinite number of problems for all the G's at X, take a functional dependence. Rho, you've introduced a function, but that's an infinite number of choices. So you're doing it once, the infinite number of problems. The same infinite number of problems just by putting a function there. And now it's straightforward to do this because you know the Poisson bracket of pi with a, and you just get spit out the derivative of rho. And I forgot the minus sign. Okay. Now, that's ultra cool because this is the variation of A under a gauge transformation. Rho is a function, and you've changed A by taking a change of A, which is adding the gradient of a function. So this is just an ordinary gauge transformation. Okay, it's a spatial gauge transformation. We're only doing it on the spatial bits, but it's a gauge transformation. And so we see a beautiful conclusion. Let's just do the other one. The other one is delta pi rho, which is the Poisson bracket. Okay, so pi at a point y with g of rho. And what's that? Well, pi has zero Poisson bracket with pi. It has zero Poisson bracket with this, so that's zero. So the pi's don't change under a gauge transformation, which you know because if you go all the way back, the pi's are the field strength, or the electric field. Another name for the pi's over here is that these are just square root of g. These are just the electric fields. What we used to call the electric fields in electricity and magnetism classes. And the electric fields are gauge invariant. So you get back that the electric fields are gauge invariant. The vector potential varies by the derivative of a function. So what you learn is that delta anything, any function of a's and pi's, given by the Poisson bracket of that anything with g of rho, is a gauge transformation. So what this constraint G does is it acts on anything in the phase space. And by taking the Poisson bracket, it generates the change in that object under gauge transformations. That's its job. So you start with some point here in the phase space. For this to be true, it doesn't have to be on the constraint surface. And take delta of that point, or have a function, and take delta of that function, and it tells you how it changes by gauge transformation. Okay, and we're going to see that happen over and over again. This is the relationship between constraints and gauge transformations that I mentioned last time. Constraints generate gauge transformations by their Poisson brackets. Yes. It's just a notation. I should have put three E's here. Okay. Yeah. No.
It does not. Good point. Delta A zero doesn't change. But A0 doesn't change under gauge transformation, which is just adds the gradient of a spatial function. What we're not seeing, what you're looking for, and what we're not seeing of this, and you're right, we're not seeing it, is you're not seeing delta A0 is the time derivative of a function. You're not seeing that anywhere. And it's not there. It's not in the phase space. Yes?
What is the pi zeros generated?
Well, if you wanted to stretch it, you can make the pi zeros do that. But we're just going to get rid of it. If you wanted, you could say that this was f dot times the Poisson bracket of a zero with pi. So you can get away with that. So you really wanted to. But A0, let me point out that A0 is gone from here. Now, I promised we would have a memory of it just in case we were nostalgic for it. It's really hiding it here, but it's really gone. It's not part of the theory anymore. So the way that used the most convenient way to deal with A0 is just to, well, I'm one step away from that, but we're gonna recognize it as zero, and we still have to get rid of pi zero to get rid of A0 consistently. So just hold on for a second. I'm still in the middle of a calculation, which is I'm doing G, the Poisson bracket of G with the Hamiltonian. Now we can sort of go by eye. So look, the G dot of X has two terms. There's the Poisson bracket of G of X with H0. H0, you remember, is all this stuff here, which is not proportional to constraints. Then there's omega times the integral. Sorry to change coordinates on you. Let me call this y everywhere. And the integral, there's the integral d3x now. Omega of x prime Poisson bracket of g of y with g of x. And then there's lambda prime Poisson bracket of g of y with pi 0 of x. So these are the terms that we have to compute. But now we have an algorithm, which is the Poisson bracket of g with anything is going to generate its gauge transformation. So look, h0 is gauge invariant. This is the electric field squared. This is the magnetic field square, and these are gauge invariants. So this is 0. G itself is gauge invariant because it's the gradient of the electric fields, which are gauge invariant. And in fact, that teaches us an interesting lesson, which is that G of X with G of Y, Poisson brackets are 0. So by the way, that's an algebra. That's an algebra where everybody commutes with each other. And so this isn't a trivial Lie algebra. There's a generator, one generator for every point of space, and they all commute with each other. So this term is 0. Yes?
Maybe this is a dumb question, but isn't that an identity because it's symmetric? Yeah, it's symmetric.
No, because x and y are different points.
Oh.
It's not a g of x with g of x would be an identity.
Oh.
Good. And pi 0, the only way that the Poisson bracket of anything with pi 0 is 0 is if there's an a 0 here, but there isn't, so this is 0. So g is preserved. So g dot is 0. And we're done. We have constraints pi 0. Pi 0 is conserved by virtue of G being imposed, and G is conserved all by itself. Okay. So now let me deal with A0 and pi 0. We have this canonical pair, A0 and pi 0. Pi 0 vanishes. That's a constraint. Nothing in the Hamiltonian is a function of A0. So we are just going to disappear these guys from now on. They don't play any role in the theory. Now, you can only do that in a Hamiltonian formulation if you can disappear variables in canonical pairs. The reason why we can disappear these is that the only thing that doesn't commute with pi 0 is a 0, and vice versa. Pi 0 is 0, and nothing depends on a 0, so we just disappear them. So we're done. I just disappear this, and that's the Hamiltonian of the theory. And notice something. Let's now compute A dot of one of the spatial components of A at some point Z, say. Okay. Well, that's the Poisson bracket of A with Z with the whole Hamiltonian. Okay. And now I'm going to start condensing steps. So how does the spatial part of A fail to have commute with any of these? Well, there's this term. And we did just this with the scalar field already. So we just bring down the 2 times the 1 half. So this is pi a of z over square root of g. But there's another term. And the other term comes from the g here, and we know that the Poisson bracket of g with the a is its gauge transformation, okay, times the omega. And the omega is here, playing the same role that rho played up there. So we get plus derivative of omega. And so we see that the evolution of A has freedom in it. Because the omegas, I'm sorry, I should be calling them omega prime, are arbitrary functions of Z and T. So this Hamiltonian is ambiguous. As it evolves, the vector potential, the gradient of the vector potential can be anything you like. And that's the arbitrariness of gauge invariance. That's the fact that the theory has gauge degrees of freedom in it. On the other hand, if we take the curl of A, then this goes away because that's the gradient of the curl. So the dot of FAB is basically, if you'll permit me the, is basically the curl of pi. Times 1 over square root of g. And that is gauge invariant. And that's one of the Maxwell's equations. Right? That's B dot is del cross E, which I believe, if I remember right, is the Maxwell equation. Now I confess I never took electromagnetism, but I think that's a Maxwell equation. Okay. And so what's good about this example, and I'm sorry for going over it in such painstaking detail, is that one sees the role of the constraints clearly, again, is doing 2 things. The constraints have to be imposed to get consistent evolution. Had we not imposed g, pi would not have stayed 0. Pi 0 would not have stayed 0. And if pi 0 had wandered off from being 0, we would be studying a dynamical system that had nothing to do with all the Lagrangian equations of motion that come from that, because the definition of pi 0 equals 0 comes from the definition of the pi's. Yes?
A dot is also supposed to be the electric field.
No.
Well, pi sub A is the electric field.
And so let's go back. The electric
and
field.
You put A not equal to 0.
Good. Oh, you're right and I'm wrong. Yes.
So, but that can't be the electric field because it has a gradient of something in it, and your constraint G says the divergence of the electric field is 0.
Yes. So what? Good. So what happened here? So let me fill out your argument. Your argument is that EA is A dot, which we just computed, minus del A, A0. Okay? Now, I insist that's essentially what this equation says, if I call the electric, if I think of the electric field as pi, and I'm willing to think of A0 as omega, because omega can be anything, and A0 is arbitrary.
Right, but I can't.
Yes, you can.
Well,
but let's think
but
through
your carefully. Constraint is also that
so, I mean, what this equation says is that pi is A dot A minus del A of something called omega prime. Remember that omega prime had in it, it really was something else plus A zero. And this object pi by construction is gauge invariant. So I think it's okay.
But you've also got an expression. But then you can't set A not equal to zero. Because you
yes, I guess you're right. What I meant when I say this period A naught is that nothing interesting happens to A naught. A naught is not a dynamical variable.
But it has a dependence on space and time.
Well, in the initial value problem, if you set up initial data, you can set up, this is good, and I don't think I said something wrong, but maybe I did, so let's think about it. You set up an initial A, an initial pi, such that divergence of pi is zero. That will consistently evolve. And you can add setting up an A0 and a pi0 such that pi0 is zero, and that will consistently evolve. Okay, how will it evolve? A0 dot is, if we haven't dropped it out, then there still is this here. And A0 dot is this free function lambda prime. Because you get the Poisson bracket with the pi0. So A0 dot is free anything you like. And A0 starts off initially. So I can make A0 anything I like, it has any evolution I would like it. The issue is, can you make a gauge invariant observable where somehow that arbitrariness in A0 messes up something else? And the claim I would make is you can't. So A0 is just free to wander off by itself. It's not going to come into anything. But linguistically, I don't know if the way I said this is a linguistic point, when we, for example, have other degrees of freedom going on, the nice thing is that the correspondence between E, the electric field, and pi is the one that holds up. The correspondence between the electric field and various components of derivatives doesn't always hold up. Okay. Any questions out there in Guelph or Western? Okay, any more questions? No? Okay. So let's take a 15-minute break, and then we'll come back again. And when we come back again, we'll do Yang-Mills theory briefly, and then we'll do BF theory. And somebody remind me to put this microphone on again when we start again.